Blog Talk Radio.
I say I will. I'll take the ride. 'Cause I'd rather have connections, pleasure and pain, than be alone here with my pride. Okay, I'll take my shot. This time I'll take my chance. 'Cause that's all I have left. If I don't, if I won't choose love and pride's all I have left. If I don't choose love.
Good evening and welcome again. I hope whether you're near or far, you're enjoying the holiday season by whatever name you call it. Thank you for taking a break from all the preparations and festivities to tune in to the very popular For Mothers and Way Shower series. I'm Karen Tate, your host, and that music opening the show this week is from the artist Laura Kane, and it's a snippet from a single of hers called Choose Love. So whether you're washing dishes, wrapping gifts, or you're just sitting warm by the fire, maybe sipping some eggnog or maybe even some sangria, thank you for your time, and this next hour is my holiday gift to you. If you tuned in the last few weeks, you know I'm experimenting with the format of the show. I'm now moving your favorite and sometimes controversial What's the Buzz segment to the bottom of the hour, so our guests don't have to wait through that What's the Buzz segment to chat. So stay tuned through the end of the show. This week we'll be covering some of the following items in What's the Buzz, time permitting. That's where we discuss the bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet all week. And some of those topics are Barbie in a burqa, ISIS temple fragment found in Alexandria, the African government of Uganda banning female genital mutilation, rogue evangelical church opens its doors fully to gays, Avatar, the new movie by James Cameron, and some other items, including our next installment of Hulda, the female Santa. And if you sent in any of those articles to me to share with listeners, you know who you are, so thank you. So you'll want to stay tuned till the end of the show while those bees vent their relief later on. I also invite you to call in and speak with our guest tonight, Patrick McCullum, whose credentials I'll share with you in a moment or two. And you can also call in and chat with me later during What's the Buzz. The call-in number is 718-766-4662. And now let me tell you a little bit about Patrick, just in case you don't know about all his work out there in the world. He is going to be talking about his experiences participating at the recent Parliament of World Religions that was just held in Australia. He's probably barely over jet lag. We're also going to talk about Cherry Hill Seminary, where he serves as chaplaincy director, and much more, including his tireless work to serve the pagan community as the Wiccan chaplain for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. But he also teaches workshops on witchcraft, magic, herb lore, and pagan history. He's well known as an activist, and he was also a key member of the Pentacle Quest team, winning the right for pagan veterans to have pentacles inscribed on their headstones. He's the national coordinator for the Lady Liberty League, specializing in resolving religious discrimination issues, and director of pagan chaplaincy, Cherry Hill Seminary. He's a minister with Circle Sanctuary and an author of a great book, Courting the Lady, A Wiccan Journey, available at courtingthelady.com. And in it, he tells of his first experiences with Goddess, and I'm hoping he'll share that with us tonight. Besides being a speaker at this year's Parliament of World Religions, he also spoke there at the same parliament in 2004 when it was held in Barcelona, Spain. And this year when he was at the parliament, he spoke on the topic of men who love the goddess. In 2008, Patrick was selected as the first pagan in history to advise the United States Commission on Civil Rights. And in Melbourne, during the parliament, he met with key officials from the Obama administration. So I'm sure he has lots of good stuff to tell us. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Well, good evening, and how are you, Karen?
I'm doing great. I'm really doing great. I'm not letting the burdens and obligations of the holidays wear me down too thin.
I'm trying. I'm still trying to come back to U.S. time from Australia, but
you're probably not even unpacked yet.
No, I'm not unpacked yet.
Well, so tell us about that. First of all, for those listeners who might not know, what is the Parliament of World Religions? And tell us, what you can about it, including what it was like meeting the officials from Obama's staff and what impressions that left you with.
Sure. Generally speaking, the Parliament is this incredible gathering of world religious leaders and also some political leaders who come from, I think this last time we had about 85 countries represented. And there were about 8,000 people who showed up in Melbourne, Australia. And they're from every imaginable religion and spiritual practice. So just to give you like a short synopsis of some of the people I got an opportunity to speak with, I got to sit down and speak with some Aboriginal elders from Australia, one of whom's family have been the spiritual kind of guides for their particular tribe or group there for 60,000 years.
Wow.
So that's somebody who's been around for quite a bit of time and has a lot of history behind them about what is spirituality, how do we look at our relationship with the earth and such. And then I got to speak with Buddhist monks. The Dalai Lama was there. I met with Catholic bishops and people from the Orthodox Christian Church, had a wonderful meeting with the American Hindu Foundation, which represents the Hindus, or at least a number of the Hindus here in the United States, and talked about their relationship with Goddess, actually.
Okay.
Then got an opportunity to meet with some, various different denominations from Protestant Christianity. And then there are quite a few pagans from around the world, various different denominations and from different countries. In particular, there were a fairly good group from Australia who were a lot of fun to meet with. And we had some interesting experiences because I presented several different things there, but one of the very first things I did was one of the opening rituals for the parliament, and it was for the solstice. However, I'm from North America, and we're celebrating the winter solstice, but in Australia, it's summer, and we're celebrating the summer solstice.
So you had to switch gears there a little bit.
Yeah, I had to switch gears, and not only that, but the directions are different in the way that the sun rises and sets there. It's like east and west are like in a different position, or actually I guess it's north and south are in a different position from east and west. That's very confusing.
Yeah, it's hard to wrap your mind around that.
Yeah, and so you're kind of doing everything in reverse from what we would do here.
Right.
If you were someone who was involved in some of the various pagan and goddess or feminist spirituality traditions from here, you'd be moving backward from what you would there. I got to meet Sufis and Sikhs and... I mean, I could just go on. There was people from Africa, voodoo priests, and if you were to walk, you have to just imagine this. Imagine a huge building that takes about 15 minutes to walk across, and 8,000 people dressed in their traditional religious garb of every color and every imaginable kind of costume you've ever seen, and then they're all there together to not so much talk or battle about religion, but to talk about how we can come together as people of the world to solve the world's problems.
Wow, that's impressive. And if that could just sort of ripple out, what a wonderful place this blue marble would be.
And I think that's the idea underlying the Parliament was that there would be the opportunity for people to talk about common issues, speak from their spirituality, and to allow that to guide them.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, Lady Olivia Robertson, Fellowship of Isis, I'm sure you probably know
yes.
who she is. She,
I've been to her castle and visited with her before.
Okay, all
yeah.
right. So she told us a story once, told listeners about her first experience there, and they were actually afraid for her life. They were worried some rogue Christian was going to try to kill her. So I guess I have to ask, this was probably a while ago,
yes.
but how are Wiccans and goddess folk looked upon there? I mean, do most of these people recognize a female face of God and Wicca as equal to their spirituality?
Well, I think that was what was so wonderful about this parliament. The last parliament, I'm going to make a very short statement here, but the last parliament in Barcelona, there was a definite kind of recognition of Wiccans, pagans, goddess, spirituality, but it was sort of generalized. This parliament, there was a straight upfront recognition of the feminine divine.
Mm.
And I would say that everyone that I met understood and knew who we were, as I'm a person who worships and follows the goddess, and I was very comfortable speaking with people from all those different faiths I named just a short while ago, and I found it really unique that many of these faiths were trying to find ways of sharing with me how they also were either currently seeking for ways or had in their past had ways of connecting with the feminine divine.
Oh, that's incredible.
And so, what a change. I mean, what
yeah.
a change over, many years. Often it's hard. We feel like maybe, we're struggling. We're not making progress. But I have to tell you, when I'm sitting there shaking hands and having a conversation with, say, a Catholic bishop, and we're having a, pretty ordinary conversation about the goddess and, how they view the goddess as how we view the goddess and that sort of thing. It's just something I never would have imagined happening.
And I know why. And you're just sort of giving me goosebumps.
Well,
it's good to know that you didn't go there and were treated like stepchildren or something,
no,
you know?
No, we were not. We were treated very well. And one thing that your listeners should know if they aren't aware of this is that we actually have three goddess worshippers of different sorts, primarily from pagan traditions, who are represented on the board of the parliament now. In other words, they've actually been voted in on the as trustees and on the board of the parliament.
Oh, that's wonderful progress.
Yeah, and they really did their job in a way that didn't particularly represent their spirituality, because they were responsible for all of the faiths that were there. The fact that we had gained enough respect to have people actually, elevated to that kind of level in this event was pretty fantastic. And there were a number of presentations that related to our beliefs and our spirituality, and they were very well attended. Most every session that there was packed.
So was everything pretty positive? No negative feedback anywhere?
I would say it was very positive. The only single negative feedback thing I saw at the entire parliament was there were a group with a big sign that said, "Jesus is the only way," who were like standing outside. But what was so unique about that is I would say, 70% of the people from the religions around the world are not Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sign was for all of us. it was nice not to be singled out and know they were just waiting for you out there.
Yeah, I mean, those folks always follow the Hare Krishna parade here at Venice Beach that they have every year. And I know what you mean. Well, that's good. That's really good feedback, Patrick. Thank you so much. And so how many years has the parliament been going on? Can anybody go? And when is the next one?
Yes, basically The Parliament's a little over 100 years old. I think it's 120, but I know that it's 100 years old. And it has an interesting history, which I believe is important for many people to show up to. And that is originally it was brought for the World's Fair in Chicago about 100 years ago. And someone got the idea to bring, you know, quote, the diversity of religions of the world together. And so they invited, from what I understand, you know, primarily the three mainstream religions for the most part. And then what happened is apparently a Swami from the Middle East showed up and kind of started to participate and then announced that they need to have others. And pretty soon they had some Buddhists and some other people who kind of came along and joined in. And it turned from a very limited conversation into a fairly open conversation. And things were talked about that had never been talked about between people before in relationship to religion and faith. And that sort of set the stage of the idea that they would invite everyone to the table. Now, of course, it took 100 years to invite us to the table, but we definitely are at the table now, and we're getting the opportunity to speak. And, you know, I think that the thing that was the most moving for me, particularly at the Parliament, was that when I would relay or speak about what was sacred to me and how I saw the divine and would describe that to somebody, they listened with true respect. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to just sort of going, oh yeah, you know, you're saying this and kind of turning their head or moving. They really listened.
Mm-hmm.
They really took in what I had to say. You could see it hit their heart. And then they would talk back with you in a way and start to include language you'd use.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, I might be talking to, you know, let's say an Eastern Orthodox Christian priest or something, and I would mention the goddess, and then that man would be talking back to me about God and such, and he'd say, you know, and God such and such. He says, well, you know, I mean, you understand I'm speaking of the goddess. And then he would go on with this conversation, and it wasn't that he was now replacing quote God in his context with the goddess, but that he was trying to give respect in our conversation to my view and my beliefs. And so that was like a really wonderful thing.
So what do you think the chances are this will ever happen in the United States anytime soon?
Well, they're deciding where it will be again. It'll be in 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the number of years that it's going to be set apart is falling around 5 to 6 years. And it depends on who takes it on and, you know, where they're going to hold it and when they can actually fit in and with other things, because it's a fairly large event, I mean, very large event, actually. And, of course, it involves a lot of extra things like huge security and such, because many of the world leaders that are coming, you know, if something happened to any of them, it would be catastrophic.
Right.
You know, and so there's a lot of planning and organization. My guess would be there's probably years of planning and organization to put it together. But it has been suggested that maybe it be brought to the United States. And I'm not sure when they make that decision, but that could happen.
Well, I hope that happens in my lifetime. I couldn't afford to go to Australia, but I would sure to travel across the United States to go. That sounds like an incredible event.
Right. Now, some of the things that I thought were, you know, special from our perspective is we had a number of wonderful presentations, and we also had a series of rituals that were done where we, you know, presided over various religious rituals which people would come to attend on the various days of the Parliament. And so, for example, we had a peace ritual that was put on by the pagans. And we had a ritual for the solstice, which I had already mentioned. And then we had there was a dancing in the directions ritual by a woman from here in my area, Wood Thorne Coyle, who's also a well-known author and fairly prominent in the pagan community here in the United States and around the world some. And there were many different organizations represented. Covenant of the Goddess had representatives doing a number of different panels. including Don Frew, who is a gentleman who has done a lot of interfaith work with many different indigenous tribes and such, you know, coming together. Then there was a historic event that took place at the Parliament, and that is that all of the indigenous peoples from around the world came together, including Native Americans from the United States, and put a document together to present to the United States government to repeal the Doctrine of Discovery. And the Doctrine of Discovery was the document that allowed some of the first Christians to come to this country, which said that anyone who wasn't Christian could not either own land nor have any say in what took place in their country, and then allowed the earliest settlers to just take their land away from them and to displace them or kill them or whatever they decided they wanted to do with them.
So what's happening with that document?
Well, that document got put together and sort of got finalized at the Parliament, and now it's going to go to the President and Congress, and, you know, we'll see what happens out of that. But it was very substantial, and it was supported by people from all these countries around the world from every religion.
Well, I think it's great that, and it seems like you really got to give, a whole variety of folks from a lot of different religions and spiritualities a taste of, what pagans and goddess folk are.
Yeah. Then there was a really special moment, which you'd mentioned, and that is that we had gotten, my wife and I, we had received a special invitation to attend a meeting, but it wasn't, you know, really clear as to what exactly the meeting was or who for sure was going to be there or anything like that. But we were just told basically that it was a meeting that we weren't supposed to be sharing with all the other people, and that there would be security and that we would just kind of show up and then they would tell us what was going on. So we went to the meeting, and there were, as I said, about 8,000 people at the Parliament who are all religious leaders. And in this meeting, I'd say, you know, I didn't count, but I'd say maybe there 50 to 60 or something like that of the people were selected out of the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that group, about half or less of them were selected to speak. And it was three top-level administrators from the Obama administration. It was Mara Vanderslice, who is the person who is the faith advisor for the whole United States and for the President. She is involved with the Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. And then there was a Peter Kovac, or Kovach, I can't remember which his correct name is, but he was one of the head people from the Department of State. And then there was the gentleman who was in charge of the Gulf states, in other words, you know, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, all that whole area there, and everything that takes place within it. And they basically talked for about a minute or two and said, what we're here for is the President sent us specifically not to tell you what's going on, not to talk about things, but to ask you what suggestions and what help you might be able to provide us to better address religious diversity and pluralism in the United States and internationally, and how we might incorporate some of those suggestions into our United States domestic and foreign policy.
So is that a big change from the attitude of the Bush administration?
I'm laughing. yes, I would say that was a significant change. First of all, that they would bother to learn about anybody else's religion or what anyone thought about religion.
Yeah, Bush would have been outside with the people holding the one-way signs.
Yes, yes. And so they genuinely wanted to know what they could do to make things better, and then they posed three questions to us that they'd like answers to, and I don't know if we get them exactly accurately, but the first one was something like, you know, if you could make a change today, or if our government could make a change today, what would it be? What would you like to see change tomorrow?
So how did people get to answer? Was it sort of a consensus answer? Or
no, each of us individually advised them.
Okay.
So we got to choose what the subject would be.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they proposed the questions to us, like, you know, how would you change foreign policy? How would you this and that? And then I stepped up in front of them, and I addressed the three of them, just me, and I said, well, this is what I think is the thing that's most important to focus on, and this is what I think you should do about it. And what I addressed was, I told them that I, in a couple of different capacities, already advised government officials in different ways about problems with religious discrimination and with not recognizing pluralism within our own country, especially in governmental institutions and agencies. So it isn't just the fact that maybe, you know, walking down the street, one church might protest against another or something. It's that you walk into a prison or the military or something, and there are distinct religious prejudice, you know, issues showing right out in the open, and they're being done by officials from our government, and no one is doing anything about it.
Yeah.
So I told them, I said, I had observed that there were those problems, but at the same time, I also had had the opportunity to advise some of these agencies and work with them, and that I found that once they learned that they were being prejudiced, and once they learned some of the ways to resolve that and how to learn about other faiths and such, that they made great progress and changed, and that the agencies became much better. And so I said, I would suggest that the Obama administration perhaps create an agency or something to specifically train governmental officials on how to promote pluralism and stop religious discrimination and provide better education, and that they also should provide a means of enforcing that and monitoring it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one of the officials said, would you be somebody interested in doing that?
And
of course I said, yes, you know, I would. I mean, I would be involved in that. And so there was a little discussion as to there's a couple of different ways that could go, like, you know, maybe someone like me or whoever else it might be they would choose would actually come forward and train some particular high-level officials for a while on how to go about this process, and then they'd go through it in the means of like a governmental agency trying to train other agencies. Or a second thing that was talked about was the concept that maybe there could be more of a partnership, kind of a government-private partnership, where someone like myself, you know, would come and train officials and maybe pick a team of a few different people who could help with that, had expertise in that area, and that it would be sort of backed up and funded by the government and carry the clout of the president. And so we had some discussion over that, and they arranged to meet with me back here in the States to carry that further. And so
that's fantastic.
I'm in that process right now, and, you know, it's still in the place of where what it will turn out to actually look like, I don't have the answer to that yet. But the fact that our president would send a delegation all the way to Australia to talk to world leaders to ask those kinds of questions, and then to talk to somebody like me,
mm-hmm.
and then to actually invite me to meet with them and maybe even take a really major active role in making that come forward, I think is such a significant change in our country.
Well, you know, I was getting a little impatient with him, but maybe now I'll give him a little bit more time.
Well, you know, it's always hard. I mean, I get very impatient too. And so I think that, it's always hard, I think. You know, I mean, often people want me to do a lot of things in just the areas that I work in, and, you know, there's, like, only so much you can do at one time, and I have a sense that maybe it isn't all that easy to be the president.
Gee, and, we think he can wave his wand and fix it all.
Yeah, but I do think that something like this is a significant shift, and it will lead to a lot of other significant shifts, and if things continue in that direction, if people are really asked about what they think, and then they're not just asked and then blown off, but actually they start to participate, there's hope. There's
right.
Real hope.
Right, absolutely. Well, this, you know, sort of segues into a comment you left me on email that, you know, your sense of it is that the feminine divine is creeping into mainstream religions. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? I mean, you sort of touched on
sure.
it, I think, but tell us more about that. How is that happening maybe socially, culturally, politically?
Right. Well, you know, I've been around for quite a long time. I mean, I first started thinking of myself as someone pursuing the feminine divine in the early 1960s. And so, you know, I watched the progression of how religion would talk about the divine just generally, and I never heard any mention or anything of the feminine divine for much of my young adulthood, I guess you would say. And over the last, like, less than 10 years, and especially in the last 3 or 4 years, I travel all over the country, even to other countries, and everywhere I go, in every church, in every synagogue, in every mosque, in every religious context I go in, they're talking about the feminine divine. So let's say you could go in for a Methodist service, and I'm not, you know, it might have been a Baptist service I was going to or Church of Christ or something else, but I'm just going to use Methodist as just a general term. You know, I go into a Methodist church, and back in the old days, you'd go in there and they'd be saying, you know, God said this and God said that. And you'll go in and listen to a sermon and they'll say, Mother God and Father God. Or they'll say something like, you know, and God presented itself. And, you know, that could be seen as however God chooses to present itself. Maybe it presented itself as man. Maybe it presented itself as a woman. Maybe it was a burning bush.
Mm-hmm.
It's as though they haven't fully shifted to the concept that that is what the divine is. But they are willing to include it, that possibility, in their conversations. And this is in mainstream faith. I'm not talking about, you know, feminist spirituality or Wicca or other forms of paganism. I'm talking about, you know, in Protestant Christianity and in Catholicism and such. And so more and more, you know, you will run into people talking in that way.
Well, why do you think it... Well, I mean, obviously, you know, one of the things I'm going to talk about later is, you know, the movie Avatar and
mm-hmm.
the Mother God and that. But why do you think it's not... you know, out there yet, where we're actually hearing it so much. Or maybe it's just my perspective, I don't know, but it's like you always seem to see just the conservative Christians on TV. You know, you never really see many other people represented in the mainstream media. Is it just who controls the mainstream media, or?
I would say yes. To the question of, you know, is it just who controls the mainstream media? I mean, my experience in the world walking around is there are a lot more people talking about it than you would ever see in the media. And I think that it might be that the media, like many other people, like many of us, but, you know, we have people who are in the closet, aren't even, you know, sharing their beliefs. And I think that it may be like that for the press, too. You know, for someone to come out on public television and start talking about the goddess or invite a person to speak from that perspective is taking a very big step forward and potentially placing themselves on the firing line.
Right.
You know, if I can think of a few shows that might well be a good place for that sort of thing to come forward. But,
I know Susan Sarandon mentioned something about her God being female on The View. You know, that sort of stands out. But
and I remember years ago, Roseanne Barr brought that out. And there are a number of other movie stars, both male and female, who have mentioned the goddess. In
mm-hmm.
fact, at the Academy Awards, I remember there was somebody who talked about the goddess. And so we're seeing little bits and pieces, but even mainstream faiths are not getting, you know, brought forward. When you go to an interfaith discussion in TV or in a large venue, it's a lot like a religious joke where they go and they say, you know, there was a priest and a rabbi and a minister.
Yeah.
And they were walking down the street.
Right.
When a person tries to represent in a lot of these councils and discussions they'll have at universities, colleges, they will consider they're having an interfaith event if they include a Muslim.
Well, and also, too, what I found at one I went to was they automatically assumed everyone there saw God as a male. It's like they weren't even aware that, you know, that there was the other gender as a as the divine, and they thought that was also interfaith.
Well, I have something I would tell everyone in your audience, which for me has been a guiding principle, and I believe that it is one of the principles that has brought about the change I shared at the Parliament. And that is that for the last, you know, 40-something years, when I speak to people about the divine, I speak about her. And, you know, at first, people sometimes are uncomfortable about that. I mean, you know, when you're sitting at your table and it's Thanksgiving and all your relatives come over and you ask somebody to say a blessing and they say, you know, Jesus bless our food or something, and as a goddess, you know, a worshiper or a person who sees the feminine divine, you just kind of sit at the table and you don't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're supporting that point of view.
But
if when it comes your turn, you say, you know, I'd like to thank the great mother of all things or something like that,
mm-hmm.
everyone else at the table might feel a little uncomfortable like you've been feeling all along. But you know what? They get over it.
Right.
And after a while, they just accept it. And then it becomes commonplace. And that's what we need to do. We need to come forward more often. We need to be not as afraid to come forward. And some places, you know, especially in this country and in some other countries too, coming forward can be dangerous. So you have to kind of weigh, you know, where you are and what's possible. But you would be surprised. I mean, you can go somewhere and say that, and all of a sudden you enter into a conversation with three other people who are sitting at your table who are also someone who thinks the same way you do, but we're afraid to say something.
Okay. Well, let's let this sort of segue into how you found the goddess. I know you, it's part of the opening of your book, Courting the Lady, and it's a beautiful story. Would you mind sharing that with the listeners?
Sure. I was 15 years old, and I decided to ride my motorcycle to my girlfriend's house, and I was involved in an accident where a lady hit me going about 60 miles an hour, and I was actually pronounced dead, for about 5.5-6 minutes. And during that time, when I was down, what you know I would call down, I had a near-death experience. And in those days, even though it's a common term to use today, they didn't even have that term. In fact, I was some professors did research on me and a bunch of other people in order to identify what a near-death experience was. But in my experience, I actually had no sense of who I was or anything, and I went through a tunnel of light, and I'm going to give you the short summary kind of, but I went through a tunnel of light, and I came to a place where there was a almost like a translucent surface of a bubble or something in front of me, and I was like just out in the middle of this tunnel of light with no concept of anything else. And a hand reached out, and I reached for the hand. It there was this sense, it was like being a baby and, you know, reaching for your mother's breast sort of thing. And I took that hand, and when I did, even to this day, you know, 40-something years later, it's hard to explain that connection and that feeling, but it was as though everything was exactly right. And then a voice asked me, said, "Are you ready?" And I didn't even know who I was. You know, I had no sense because it was as though I was removed from being myself. You know, I had gotten smashed in this accident, and I was just floating out in space, and I didn't even know I was me. And then the voice asked me the question again, and at some point I actually said, "I don't understand, you know, who are you?" And the bubble broke and kind of moved away, and there was this woman holding my hand. And she was, I like to describe it in my book, There's no way really to describe her, but for me, she was kind of like a grandmother in the sense, not old, but in the sense of when you read a storybook and it talks about, you know, a grandmother who's baking cookies in a Victorian oven and she smells like laundry soap and vanilla and she snuggles you to her breast and you feel all safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it felt like. And then I said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I'm God." She didn't say, "I'm goddess." She said, "I'm God." Now, I was a Methodist. And so, you know, there was nothing in my concept or vocabulary to even imagine something like that. But when she said it, I knew it was true.
So you didn't have a split second when you thought it was maybe Mary?
No, I didn't have any, there was nothing. She said, "I'm God," and I knew absolutely that was true. The unique thing in looking back at it, there's never been any point in time, even from then, where I've come to the conclusion that she couldn't present herself any old way she wanted to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I think if, you know, there was somebody that thought that, you know, a giant white swan was what God should look like, maybe she could come forth that way for them.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so that's how, for me, I kind of justify different ways of how people see God.
Right.
But she was goddess. And so the minute she said it, I knew it was true. And then I had a sense that, you know, wow, I understood what her question was. Her question was I ready to die or to quit or to go? And you know how they say in movies and stuff, you know, your whole life goes in front of you? Well, it did. It like zoomed in front of me. And now you have to picture, I was 15 then. Now I'm a grown man, but I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I actually had a little conversation with her when I told her, no, you know, I don't want to die. I want to get a new motorcycle, you know. I want to have sex with my girlfriend. I mean, the kind of stuff, you know, that sounds really stupid now listening about it, but it's what I was saying because I was 15.
Sure.
And there was a little, just a sense of sadness kind of in her eyes and the way she, just the feeling of I'm still holding her hand. And she said, well, there'll be pain. I said, I don't care. She let go of my hand and I fell. It was incredible, like, it was almost as though you were within some kind of a force field and there was no light anymore or anything, and it got tighter and smaller and I fell faster and faster and felt like I was really constricted. It was much like going through a womb, if you were, you know, if I were to imagine what that would be like. And all of a sudden somebody said, "We got him back." And I opened my eyes, and I was in, like, horrible pain. I mean, my arms and legs were broken, and I was all torn up and all kinds of stuff. And as bad as everything was, I told the paramedics, I saw God. And they said, well, that's not surprising. You know, you were gone for all this time. And I said, but God was a woman. And the paramedic patted me on the head and said, don't worry, son, you'll be okay.
You'll come out of it.
Yeah. And from that experience, I had a couple, that was an actual real experience of talking with her. After that, I had a couple of more like visions where she came to me. And at one point, I finally just said in this vision I was in with her, I said, what is it, this is like less than a year after this, I said, what is it that you want? You know, what do you want from me? I mean, you know, I'm having a hard enough time. I'm going around people like telling people I saw God and she's a woman and everybody thinks I'm crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but it was real. And so I had to tell people. And she said, I want you to serve me. And it was really easy. I just said, okay. And I've been doing that for 40-something years. That's all I do. I listen to what she tells me. That's why I'm talking to presidents and, you know, getting people rights and working with prisoners. And everything I've done is under her guidance.
So let's talk about that. You're the Wiccan chaplain for the state of California Department of Corrections. And recently, I understand you filed a brief. I think it's called In a Friend of the Court Brief.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to explain about all of that? And you know,
sure. Well, one of the things that I noticed, I've actually been working for about 13 years in the California Department of Corrections, which is the prison system for California. And it's the largest prison system in the United States. There's more people, unfortunately, incarcerated in California than anywhere else in the world.
Mm.
And, for example, one prison I go to has over 7,000 women in it.
Huh.
And so there are huge numbers of people who are in these prisons. And so I've been working with the Wiccan and other types of pagan and Dianics and various different goddess-based spiritualities in the prisons now with a couple of thousand inmates of both male and females at numerous different institutions. And I noticed right away that the institutions would keep them from practicing, would punish them for saying that they believed in the goddess. I know many men and women who have been locked in solitary confinement. In fact, I know one man who refused to deny the goddess, and they locked him up in solitary confinement for a year.
Mm.
This is putting him in a cell where he has no other human contact, and he never gets to, you know, go anywhere, do anything, or nothing at all.
That can make a person crazy.
Just because he won't renounce the goddess. And
I mean, how can they get away with that, though, Patrick?
That's the question.
Be freedom of religion.
That's the question, but there is a separation between what is supposed to happen and what does happen, and it requires people coming forward and saying it's not right and trying to stop it before you can stop it. And so what I did is, after years of seeing this kind of discrimination and seeing horrible things happening to people and also being treated horribly myself, I've actually been taken into, I was a chaplain working in the California Department of Corrections, and they actually took me into custody.
Why?
You know, well, I mean, they made up a whole story and said that this sounds like a joke when I'm telling it, but they asked me to come to the prison to meet with inmates who'd won a court case to be able to see somebody and talk about the goddess. And so I went to the prison. I had state ID. They let me in the prison, let me in to see the men. I met with men, and when I came back out, they took me into custody and charged me with breaking into a maximum security prison with no authorization, subverting security, and,
that would have been impossible for you to even do, I would
say.
Of course
it would be impossible for me to do, but they still did it, and it took they shut down my pagan, you know, goddess prison chaplaincy for 7.5 months by saying that, you know, I was doing criminal activity by coming into the prison and wasn't supposed to be there, and that I broke into the prison and managed to get through all the security and all stuff like that. For 7.5 months, they shut me down and kept me from being able to visit any of those men and women. And then in the end, they admitted that they were wrong and wrote me a letter of apology, and then figured, well, so that's supposed to make it all okay.
So the people who were behind it, there was no disciplinary
nothing done
action?
To them. Nothing done to them. And so I filed a court case against the California Department of Corrections and the state, and I charged that they were discriminating against us and other minority faiths. It isn't only us, but they were really discriminating against us in a big way. And also, I discovered during the course of this, I'm a highly qualified candidate as a chaplain. I advise state and federal institutions all across the country, and even in some other countries, and have very high, you know, level of acceptance and responsibility in that context. And they would not allow me to turn an application in to become a chaplain, not based on my experience, my education, my background, or any other thing. They turned me down from even turning in an application because of my faith. And,
wouldn't that be a clear-cut lawsuit?
It is. It's a clear-cut lawsuit. So I've actually been in a lawsuit for 5 years over that incident, been gone through a lot of difficult times, and, you know, it's not easy trying to take the entire state and government on. I mean, there's a lot of threats and a lot of things they can do to you, which they all did. And, you know, you just hang in there and do the best you can. And then what ended up happening is I challenged this idea. The state came forward and said that there are 5 state-sanctioned faiths. Now, that's directly contrary to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
There can't be official state faiths. But they claim that there are, and that that's the reason they won't hire anybody from our faith or any other minority faith, is because they only recognize 5 religions. The government only recognizes 5.
And what are the 5?
It's Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, and Native American. And I might mention that the Jews, the Muslims and the Native Americans had to sue in order to get included. And back quite a long period of time ago, I had also heard that the Jews had to sue in order to get included. So I just challenged the whole thing. I said it's unconstitutional to have government faith, and that you have to have a policy which treats everyone equally. And so the state has been fighting me that for 5 years, and the Attorney General for the state of California actually made the argument that religion in California, but he's also talking about other places, but he was focusing on California, is two-tiered. There are the faiths that were meant to be given the rights under the Constitution.
Meant to be.
And then there are second-tier faiths that are meant to be given rights equal to the other second-tier faiths, but not equal to those of the state-sanctioned faiths. And so, you know, that, you know, I just wouldn't go for that. So I filed this suit, and I've been fighting it. And then a judge came along in our case and ruled after 5 years that I didn't have standing to bring the case because it should have been an inmate who brought the case, and that even though I'd been discriminated against in employment, that as a person applying for a job, I did not have standing or a right to sue against a policy that was discriminatory towards me.
Well, aside from that being crazy, I'm thinking what would have happened to this poor inmate? He would have just disappeared, probably, if an inmate had brought a charge.
Oh, sure. And I'll let you know that, remember I told you I was out of the prison for about 7 months, you know,
right,
that they kept me out?
Yeah.
Well, during that period of time, and also since, the state has denied people who worship the goddess the ability to have someone like me or anybody for our faith be with them or help them through as they're in the process of dying and passing away.
And did you share this with the Obama administration?
I have not yet, but I do intend to. And so I've had individuals who have written official requests and such for me to come and be with them, and the state has allowed them to die alone.
Mm.
And this is not true for other faiths that are in the mainstream. So if I were a Protestant and I wanted somebody, or if I were a Catholic or I were a Jew, I could just ask and they have somebody come right in. But they denied that person the ability to meet with me or me to meet with them.
So now is this something that could go all the way to the Supreme Court, or it's
Next, we're in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right now. And the thing that I think is the most fascinating about that is that, so we went to the Court of Appeals. And when you were talking about a friend of court, of the court brief, that's actually a brief that other people who are interested in supporting you in your case, who have a stake in your winning, come forward and sign on saying that they're supporting you, and then, you know, file that with the judge to let the judge know that they support you and to say why they support you. And I had 3 separate amicus briefs, or amicus briefs is what they call those briefs, filed by different groups. And among those groups who filed were the American or Catholic American or American Catholic Chaplains Association, the Jewish Defense League, the American Correctional Chaplains Association, representing all chaplains from all faiths in the United States, then organizations like People for the American Way and Americans United for Separation in Church and State, the Hindu American Foundation, and the Buddhists came on board. And so anyway, basically, the largest interfaith organizations in the world signed on, people from them. We had huge support from all across the country saying that it's not right that we're being denied our rights and not getting our day in court and not getting, you know, our needs met and heard. And so it's in the Ninth Circuit right now. And if the Ninth Circuit were to rule against us, or if they ruled for us and the state were to appeal, then it will go to the United States Supreme Court.
And what do you think the chances are there?
Well, you know, it's always hard to say how that would go, you know, because if the case were actually heard, I have no doubt we would win. But the question is, would the court hear the case? Because often, you know, the United States Supreme Court will often send cases back to the lower courts and let them get kind of hashed out in different states first, you know, so that they get more information about what it is. So, for example, let's say I won the case in the Ninth Circuit, and then the state wanted to appeal that case. The United States Supreme Court could just deny hearing the case, and then I would just win.
But, I mean, we live in Blue State, California. How can that even be happening?
You know, there is a phenomenon that I've observed that people really need to be aware of, and that is that there are certain fundamentalist Christian groups, and this is not your, you know, average, you know, good neighbor Christian who, you know, belongs to most of your normal churches. This is a very tight, well-organized group, a very far right, who are infiltrating our government and our institutions.
Well, and aren't they also infiltrating the military, I've heard?
Oh, yeah. They're infiltrating the military and such. And so what they're doing is they are literally placing them, they're grooming people over years under like a plan and placing them in positions of power until they've got everybody in a position of power. I just recently went, for example, to one of the prisons, and I learned for the very first time that the top four people from the top warden down are all ministers of a particular, you know, Protestant faith that thinks a certain way. And so you just wonder, how did that happen?
Right.
I mean, how is it possible with the great pool of possibilities in a place like California that you ended up with every person who got hired all belongs to the same group?
Right.
And so that tells you there's some things going on in the background that probably are illegal and unconstitutional. And my hope is that our Justice Department and, you know, other entities will look into that.
Okay.
But
well, that brings me to when will that be heard in the Ninth District?
It's going to be in February.
Okay.
And so, you know, I should be able to tell you a date since it's my case, but it's something I try very hard not to focus on all the time,
mm-hmm.
because I've had 5 years of this being my primary life of
exhausted.
Fighting every day, you know,
mm-hmm.
Trying to not just fight for me, but I'm fighting for all of us across the entire country.
Absolutely.
This will set precedent,
yeah.
And it'll affect every goddess worshiper in the country.
Yeah, I mean, this could break things open in a big way for people to be able to feel safe to speak out and be who they
exactly.
are.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, you did have a win with the Pentacle Quest team.
Well, we did. And, you know, one of the interesting things that came out of my case and also came out of the Pentacle case is the way that certain entrenched religious groups who are in the government look at how they can resolve an issue when it comes forward in litigation. So it was actually suggested when we were doing the Pentacle case, I mean, it never happened, but it was suggested that a resolution to that whole issue of whether a Wiccan should get to have his religious symbol on his tombstone the way other religions get to have theirs would be that the fix would be they would grind the religious symbols of every other faith off every military tombstone in the United States.
So they'd rather get rid of them all than
exactly,
give Wiccans.
Rather than give the one person who wanted theirs. And this is a little like what's happening in California. The state has actually proposed that if it turns out that I win my case, and that there should be the opportunity for, you know, goddess worshipers to be able to be hired as chaplains if they're qualified to do so, that the state might shift to firing all the chaplains in the state rather than let that happen.
So what would that accomplish? They'd just have to start all over again, start a new hiring
process.
Well,
you know, hey, I'm not them, and I wouldn't call them the world's best strategists. I mean, you know, to me, it's a no-brainer that all this is against the law and against the Constitution, and I don't know why they're defending it. And in the long run, whether my case is won or lost, their case will be lost at a point because it is against everything that we all believe in this country.
Well, and also, too, I guess I'm just amazed that more of this isn't, again, in the mainstream media, but...
Is
it on a national public radio or, you know, more liberal talk?
Been in some of those places, but it's been kept a little more low-key. I think that there's a couple things that contribute to that. Some of them I'm not going to share because they're strategic things relating to the case, which, you know, are still in our in our favor. But one of the things is that the couple times when our case did come to the forefront and there were some major events taking place, at the exact same time, like within a day or so, there was major world events taking place, which really took the press.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we get something like our case is being heard and they're making a decision on the same day Obama got to be the first black president in the United States.
Right.
You know, and so there's no way you're going to get press coverage about something
sense.
And so that was more what has happened. But there are people waiting to write the story, and I think they're kind of waiting to see what's going to happen in this hearing.
Okay. Well, now tell us about Cherry Hill Seminary. For those who don't know, what is Cherry Hill Seminary?
Well, Cherry Hill Seminary is a wonderful and unique newer concept, and that is the idea that all the other mainstream faiths have seminaries where they train their clergy how to interact with the public. Now, this is different than making somebody more, more worthy or something in the eyes of God. In other words, somebody graduating from Cherry Hill Seminary is not necessarily validated as a priest or priestess of the goddess or something like that. Rather, what it is it's a means of taking people who serve in those positions in our community and giving them the kind of equivalent training that other clergy would have, so that when one of the people who is a minister, if you would use that word, or priest or priestess or chaplain or whatever from our faith group, ends up in a room with people from another faith group who are ministers, that they can kind of hold their own,
mm-hmm.
You know, that somebody doesn't turn around on the other side and say, yeah, well, you know, I had 4 years of training in this, and I've had counseling experience, you know, in classes, and then I've learned about world religions, and I know who all the philosophers are, and I know what the origins of religion and everything are, and then we have a person who says, yeah, I'm a priestess, four people in my group got together and decided to make me that. You know, we want to give the people who are our leaders in our different small circles and groups the ability, if they wish, to have the kind of credentials that can help them to stand against people from the other faith and be taken seriously. And so Cherry Hill Seminary offers that. We have some master's programs. For example, there's a master's in chaplaincy, and this would be an accredited master's degree. That you could go and take classes in. And Cherry Hill Seminary is an online seminary. It does have some face-to-face requirements, so there are a few times, twice a year, you have to actually be in face-to-face things with some of the professors. The people who teach the classes are all pagans and goddess worshipers, and they're all PhDs and masters degrees and such, so they're all qualified teachers, you know, professors in their field. And you can go there and, like I said, you could get a master's degree or you could just get, you know, basic training in certain areas, like maybe you're someone who wants to learn more about counseling, so you can do, you know, more in-depth counseling with people in trauma or in rape centers or in whatever it is, but be speaking from our spiritual perspective.
I see. Okay.
And then there's a second component of Cherry Hill Seminary, which is a non-accredited component where they have also classes that you can take where you can learn some of the same types of things and also things like constructing public ritual and various different things, but that you don't have to quite hold yourself to as high of a standard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you were in my chaplaincy program for under the master's program, you would be required to be writing essays every week and, you know, doing major projects and probably going into prisons and, you know, working with people and doing X hundreds of hours of counseling and all these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are just not really looking to go that far.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And so what Cherry Hill has also tried to do is offer something for people who just want to be better equipped to serve their community but are not looking for a degree.
I see. Okay.
So we have both things available.
It's two-tiered. It's two-tiered. So you really have a lot to offer for a variety of folks out there.
Yeah. So, I mean, one could sign up for something so simple as boundaries and ethics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you could take a class and learn the foundation of the concept of ethics and boundaries. You know, when you're in a small group with a bunch of people, is it appropriate to say and do certain things, and when isn't it?
Exactly.
And those kinds of things are things that, quite frankly, our community needs to spend a little more time on.
I think you're right. Well, now, what is the website for Cherry Hill? Do you have that living in front of your brain?
Yes, it is www.cherryhill.org.
Okay, that's easy. Well, Patrick, we're starting to run out of time, and it's been a wonderful talk, but I don't want to close off before I ask you, is there anything you want to make sure you mention or any important ideas you want to leave listeners with, maybe advice
yes.
on how we can shift things forward? Or
there are a couple of things that, you know, are my sort of pet projects that I believe really are helpful to our community overall, and I'd like to mention one or two of them. And
sure,
so
go ahead.
One
please.
Of them is that I am heavily involved with the Lady Liberty League. And the Lady Liberty League you can find more about by going on the website circlesanctuary.org and then click on the icon for Lady Liberty League. And who the Lady Liberty League are people who worship the goddess from around the country who it's a smaller group of people who are experts in a few different fields relating to fighting for people's rights for all of us. We aren't paid. Everything we do is on our own nickel, all our phone calls, our plane flights, everything we do we pay for ourselves. But when someone comes and takes on someone, you know, tells them they can't have their job because they learn that they worship the goddess, or tells them that they can't, you know, be a chaplain in the prison, or that they can't have certain rights in the military, we take that on and we put ourselves together and we don't let up until we win that. And Lady Liberty League is 100% supported by donations. And so people who are interested can either donate, and if they don't have money to donate, then they can find ways by going on the site and checking in with it that they can help. So, for example, I'll give you an idea of a Lady Liberty League sort of thing. We're having this case moving forward which will affect every goddess worshiper in the United States. And there's talk about organizing a rally and bringing people from around the country to, you know, protest this idea that the state would rule us out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one of the sort of things that there could be a lot of people who live somewhere around where they're having the rally who'd like to support Lady Liberty League or support their greater, you know, national community, don't have the money to do it, but could come down for an hour and just stand there with a sign or something.
Right, right. It doesn't cost them anything.
It doesn't always have to be that you put money out.
Right.
You know, or you could do something like donate a phone card. You know, I mean, we spend a tremendous amount of money out of our own pockets making long-distance phone calls to defend someone who's not able to defend themselves. So that's an important one. And then the last thing that I would like to say is that we very much need other people to come forward who would like to share their experience of the goddess with prisoners. And this is all across the United States. And, you know, different than what most people think about prisons. I've been in prisons for about 13 years now. The largest majority of the people in there are not what we see on TV as criminals. Many of these people are people like you and me. I mean, I have a woman who's been in my group for 4 years who was involved in an accident. She's a straight-A college student, 22 years old, who was involved in an accident with someone else and got charged with negligent homicide, and she's 10 years in prison. And a lot of people who have drug addiction problems, many, many women in the prisons who have, somehow retaliated against a spouse or a boyfriend in an abusive relationship where there's 10 years of some man beating her or cutting her up or doing something, and then one day she just has it and stabs him back with his own knife and goes into prison for 10 years. And those people need us to show up. And, you know, I'm one guy, and there are a few other people showing up, but we sure could use some help.
So how, if someone wanted to do that, how do
they... Somebody wants to do that, they could email me directly at chaplaindirector@aol.com.
And that brings me to a question that always comes up. I get countless letters from people who are incarcerated asking for all sorts of support. The last letter I got was someone who asked me to be their sponsor. Or they want books, or they want a connection, you know?
Right.
What can those of us who, you know, what can we do? Because I think you maybe told me once, we just can't mail books and things like that. And
yeah, there's a whole process, and it's really too complicated to talk about.
Okay.
Here, I'm going to give you a couple ideas, but if people would try to email me and ask me the questions, I'd be happy to help them or refer them.
Okay.
Cherry Hill Seminary, if you take the most basic course they have, which is a survey of chaplaincy, we cover all those issues.
Okay.
And it's something you take online, and you don't have to show up every time. You don't have to take it for credit. But ultimately, each institution in every different state has different rules about what you can and can't do. You have to obviously be careful if you're interacting with inmates. If you're going to do that and you have no one to guide you and no experience, then you don't want to do it identifying where you live and from your home phone and things like that. Instead, you want to write from a P.O. box or someplace so you have some level of safety until you really know who it is you're writing to. And as far as making donations and such, you can look up and call your local correctional institution, ask for whoever's in charge of chaplaincy, and tell them you want to donate some books to the religious library at the institution and find out what their policy is and how you go about doing that. If all else fails, you can actually donate books to me. You can, again, go back to the chaplaindirector@aol.com and ask me how to do it, and you can send books. You can send ritual items like chalices or, you know, candles or incense or whatever you might have. And I do have the ability to send and ship these items in because I'm authorized as a vendor, and I also have a legal church. Anyone who has a legal church can also send items in. And so these are some of the ways you can get stuff to these people. And what happens is that the institutions do everything they can to keep these people from having these things. And, you know, the reason we should support the people from our own faith group is not because they're criminals and they just need the help, but it's because all of the other faith groups are allowed to send stuff in. So if you're someone who worships the goddess, you're not allowed to have, you know, a figurine of the goddess or a poster of the goddess or a book about the goddess or something like that. But if you're some other mainstream faith, all those things are allowed, and every one of those inmates has that stuff in their cells and, you know, on their walls and in the chapels and all over the place. And so we are being kept from having it, and one of the excuses the institutions use is no one is coming forward to donate that stuff.
Okay.
Of course, they're not looking for anybody to donate the stuff.
Well, and I know there have been times when things have been sent to chaplains and it never did reach, reach the prisoners either. So.
And that happens all the time, but it's far better to send it and then try to have a tracking method or something. You know, like I actually go to the trouble when I send my things. It costs more money, but I go to, trouble, send something certified mail or send it by UPS or FedEx or something. And I keep a tracking receipt and a number, and then I keep in connection with whoever I sent it to. And if it doesn't get there, then I write a letter to the institution and tell them I have a tracking number and I want an accounting of what happened to that, because I am a voter in whatever state it is, and I have a right to that information and knowledge.
And you know it arrived at the prison, obviously, so
exactly.
Where is it?
Yeah, and so, there's ways of pushing, and if you don't want to push, then what you do is you contact Lady Liberty League and you say, I sent a whole box of books to such and such institution in Minnesota and it never got there and I want to know what happened. And trust me, we will get on that.
Wonderful. Okay, Patrick. Well, thank you. Thank you for your, obviously your tireless efforts for being out there on the front lines for all of us and for Goddess too. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you and you have a wonderful night.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. I am going to take just one brief break here for only 1 minute, and then I'm going to return for our What's the Buzz segment, and I'm going to let you listen to the Bard song by Jenna Green for just 1 minute, and I'll be right back.
We honor now the Celtic Bard. We offer up our praise. Guardians of our mysteries, keepers of the old days.
Hope you enjoyed our guest, Patrick McCullum, Wiccan chaplain, who is obviously a serious mover and shaker out there in the world, and we are definitely lucky to have him on our side. I am going to go ahead and try to get through all the What's the Buzz items tonight, but if I don't, I'll just save them for next week. So, first one is Barbie in a Burka. Now, maybe you already heard about this, but I just found out that one of the world's most famous children's toys, Barbie, has been given a new look. She's actually wearing a burqa. They say at the Daily Mail Reporter, which is a UK paper, that wearing the Islamic dress, the iconic doll is going undercover for a charity auction in connection with Sotheby's for the organization called Save the Children. More than 500 Barbies went on show recently at the Salon de Cinquecento, I believe, in Florence, Italy. Makers Mattel are backing the exhibit, which is the work of Italian designer Iliana Loreno. The company director of Laird Assessors from the Wirral Cheshire said, bring it on, Burka Barbie. I think this is a great idea. It's important for girls, wherever they are, that they should have the opportunity to play with a Barbie that they feel represents them. Well, as you can imagine, that got very positive and negative responses. I'll just read a couple of them from the folks who commented on hearing about Burka Barbie. One said, Burka Barbie, will Burka Barbie not be allowed to go out of the toy box without a chaperone if Action Man is in the room? What happens if a brother and sister both want to play with their dolls at the same time? Another one says, the burqa is not traditional Islamic dress. It was invented by a recent and horrific regime. It's not in the Quran that women need to cover entirely. They just have to dress modestly. Another woman was much more humorous about it. She said she was lying on the table in the doctor's office, having her sides slowly and painfully stitched back up. And she says, how dare this newspaper print something so ludicrously funny while she's going through that? Another said, is she only allowed to remove her veil when all the boys have gone for tea? So anyway, that's very interesting. You can see that they're in different colors. They're in green and blue and orange, and they either have just the traditional veil or they actually have the whole burqa with only the eyes visible, which some people refer to as the beekeeper burqas. So now Barbie is in a burqa. And the next item, it is archaeological in interest. There was an Isis temple fragment, which dates back to the Cleopatra era, that was found sunken off the coast of Alexandria in the Mediterranean. Archaeologists last week hoisted a 9-ton temple pylon from the waters of the Mediterranean that was part of the palace complex of Cleopatra before it became submerged for centuries in the harbor of Alexandria. The pylon once stood at the entrance of a temple to Isis. It's to be the centerpiece of an ambitious underwater museum planned by Egypt to showcase the sunken city. It's believed to have been toppled into the sea by earthquakes in the 4th century. Divers and underwater archaeologists use a giant crane and ropes to lift the 9-ton pylon covered with seaweed out of the murky waters. It was part of a sprawling palace from which the Ptolemaic dynasty ruled Egypt and where 1st century BC Queen Cleopatra wooed the Roman general Mark Antony before they both committed suicide after their defeat by Augustus Caesar. And this is a quote from the coastal geoarchaeologist Jean Daniel Stanley of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. He says, the cult of Isis was so powerful, it's no wonder Cleopatra chose to make her living quarters next to the temple. Egyptian authorities hope that eventually the pylon will be part of an underwater museum, an ambitious attempt to draw tourists to the country's northern coasts, often overshadowed by the grand pharaonic temples of Luxor in the south and the Giza pyramids outside Cairo. Keeping on the subject of archaeology, you might want to pick up the January-February issue of Archaeology. They have some great articles in it. One is about Iron Age priestesses, the discovery of a powerful female bloodline uninterrupted for 200 years in the Iron Age necropolis of Orthi Petra, is illuminating the role of women in the so-called Dark Ages of Greece. There's another article about the beautiful Amazon mosaics found in the Turkish city, which used to be ancient Edessa. It's surrounded by desert bound by the Taurus Mountains to the north and the Euphrates River to the east and Syria to the south. They say few tourists ever go to this part of southeastern Turkey except to visit the 12,000-year-old site of Göbekli Tepe, the world's first temple. But fewer than 10 miles from the sanctuary is another archaeological site of great interest, a palatial home decorated with these fine Byzantine mosaics depicting bare-breasted Amazons, exotic animals, and figures from Greek mythology. Also from the In the Trenches column of that same issue, they talk about Aphrodite statues found in Israel, and they also have an article on Copper Age thinkers. They're showing and talking about figurines from Romania dating back to 5,000 to 4,600 BC, were rendered in contemplative poses. and a popular Copper Age motif. The people of the Copper Age cultures that flourished in today's Bulgaria, Romania, and Moldova lived in enormous villages, some of which were larger than Mesopotamia's earliest cities. They were specialized craftspeople, especially metal workers, and were among the world's most accomplished. Yet here in the United States, these remarkable chiefdoms are only known, if at all, for inspiring the idea that ancient Europeans were goddess worshippers. Well, if you're near New York, a new exhibit, The Lost World of Old Europe, Danube Valley, 5000 to 3500 BC, is running at the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World in New York till April 25th, 2010, and it reminds us that there was much more to this neglected area of the world. The exhibit showcases a fair number of voluptuous goddess figurines and more than 250 other excavated artifacts. So if you're in New York, you'll want to take a look at that, or if you have the magazine, you can find out a bit more. Also important, before we run out of time, I wanted to mention that Uganda has moved to ban female circumcision or female genital mutilation. This comes from a CNN article. It says the Ugandan parliament unanimously passed a bill banning female genital mutilation, a traditional rite that has sparked an international outcry and is practiced in some African and Asian communities. And as immigrants move into the West, it also moves into the West. The practice, which involves cutting off a girl's clitoris, is also called female circumcision. In some communities in eastern Uganda, it's practiced in girls up to age 15. Convicted offenders face 10 years in prison, but if the girl dies during the act, those involved will get a life sentence, according to officials in the East African country. A majority of Ugandans felt it is a disgusting act, but you have to remember that this is a cultural belief that has been practiced for generations, and that's what took the bill so long to pass. Well, this is a move in the right direction, certainly. Uganda still, though, has some work to do when it comes to whether they're going to actually pass a pending law called that's really about killing gay people. I'll keep you posted on that. So we're actually starting to run out of time tonight, so I'm going to save the rest of the What's the Buzz items for next week. We'll talk about the Evangelical Church in Denver that's opening its door to gays, and the movie Avatar, the new that's out this past weekend by James Cameron. You can, in the meantime, read my article reviewing it at examiner.com if you like. So quickly, before the show comes to a close, I want to let you know that next week we're going to have Isaac Bonowitz on the show, followed the first week in January by Miriam Robbins Dexter, then Louisa Teach, Carol Christ, and we will end January with Jean Shinoda Bolin. Those are our guests coming up in the ongoing Four Mothers and Way Showers series. So, I'd like to close with tonight's evening prayer. I'd invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me. Bring an even deeper focus to the lovely words I'm about to share with you. Great Queen, Mother, and She of the Throne, in this, the dark of the year, divine magic remains the sacred spark within me. Each day I remember and I use it well. Thank you, Creatrix of Life. Blessed be. And that prayer comes from the Goddess Temple in Orange County. Well, good night, listeners, for another week. Please enjoy the holidays, and thank you for tuning in. I hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday when our guest, as I mentioned, is going to be Isaac Bonowitz. And I'm going to close out the show with some music by Jenna Green called Dance With Me. Good night, listeners, and see you next week.
You'd had enough, such worry on your face I could tell. Be that to drinking to stop you from thinking about your day of living hell. Well, the bass are playing, the fiddler is playing, the bar.